kids, it's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe, and I'm on a new computer, Cole. I'm on a new computer. Computer.
Look, our production quality has improved 22%.
Unfortunately, the content quality has gone down 22%.
That's because we let Jacob Garner here.
Damn. Pretty snappy with those comebacks.
I mean, we have to be when you're here.
Yeah. Look how long it takes him to come back with something.
I just ripped ass, so I hope it showed up on the podcast recording.
No. Nobody knows how long it took for you to actually come back with something, because Joe's going to be able to truncate silence in a timely manner now.
Yeah, instead of it taking all. It's amazing. I did some editing of the last episode on the new computer, and something that would normally take 20 minutes to do took about 2.
Yeah. Welcome to 2020.
Yeah. No shit. People know how bad my computer used to be, and I was playing Forza Horizon 4 on ultra settings.
Yeah. How's it feel?
It moves really smoothly.
It does.
It does.
Your computer is on par with mine. You are just like a couple tiny steps down the ladder.
I want more RAM. That's what I know I want.
Yeah, that's one area I've got you, because I have 32 gig of RAM. But yeah. RAM is one of those things, like, for playing games, 16 gigs is going to kill it. You're going to be fine. In fact, we literally have Dee's computer over here right now, because I just put another motherboard and processor and RAM in it for him. So he's about to be feeling like you. Nice. He didn't get near as nice an upgrade, but you know, for most people, 16 gig of RAM is going to be fine. But when you're doing editing, when you're doing video work, when you're doing digital art, when you're doing any kind of creator task, you really need 32 or more.
Yeah. So I want to invest in more RAM. From what I can tell, there are slots for more RAM. Yes. I just don't know what kind I need.
I can tell you.
You'd be able to. Oh. Yeah. We'll figure that out in the future. For now, though, I have a new computer. Oh, yeah. My God, I have a new computer.
Woo.
And Jacob's here.
And the crowd goes wild.
So, Jacob, how have you been?
I moved to a new place.
How'd that go?
It was a shit show. Completely.
Nice.
But, you know, like all moves are, I've yet to actually experience a move that went smoothly, but, you know, that's part of growing up and being an adult, probably. So we moved out of our little tiny house, and it's now a two-story, three-bedroom, one-and-a-half bath, you know, all the bells and whistles except for air conditioning. So we've gone out and bought, like, 4 air conditioners and... You know.
Yeah, luckily, those are a must.
Yeah. Especially, you know, for us fat people.
Oh, God, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We don't have central air conditioning in our house. We just have window fans and window units everywhere.
That's all we have. We have 2 window units downstairs and 1 upstairs in the bedroom. And the one in the bedroom struggles sometimes. It's only a 5,000 BTU. And on the really warm days, like, we have to have a fan running and the air conditioner running.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, like, a blanket going over the door so that the cats could still come in and out, but the door's still open. So.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, it would probably help if you weren't covered by, like, 1,500 cats when you sleep.
I'm not covered in cats. That's Ashley.
Gabe sleeps with me. and he does not sleep. Like, if I'm not feeling well, that's one of the funny things. If I'm not feeling well, Gabe will lay on David, but he'll lay his head on me because he likes me better. But when it hurts, he doesn't, 'cause he's a fat motherfucking cat. I think I've mentioned before, he weighs like 18 pounds. He's obscene. And he can't always lay on me. Sometimes it just fucking hurts.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
Fat animals are the best.
They are. I was noticing earlier, Cass was laying on a shelf, and literally his belly was flopped over the edge of the shelf. He's a big boy. He's coming right along.
Oh, Jesus. Speaking of things coming along, we do have some reviews we have to take care of on this episode. Should we dive into them? Because, Jacob, I don't want to put up with you that long.
That's fair, because I don't want to put up with Cole that long.
Sad face. I'm a beacon of joy.
You know, sometimes when you show up on the podcast, other times when you're not there. Yeah,
I'm a beacon of joy.
Speaking of beacons of joy, the first game to talk about is called SpongeBob SquarePants Battle for Bikini Bottom Rehydrated, developed by Purple Lamp, published by THQ Nordic, released June 23rd on Xbox One, Switch, and PS4 for $29.99. The cult classic is back, faithfully remade in SpongeTastic Splendor. Play as SpongeBob, Patrick, and Sandy. Show the evil plankton that crime pays even less than Mr. Krabs. Want to save Bikini Bottom from lots of rampant robots? Of course you do. Want to underpants bungee jump? Why wouldn't you? Want to join forces in a brand new multiplayer mode? The battle is on. Jacob, tell us about SpongeBob SquarePants Battle for Bikini Bottom Rehydrated.
I'm not saying that entire title every single time I talk about this.
That's okay. I understand.
Okay. So, all right, so this is my first review in a while, mainly because of the whole freaking move thing. But also, like, it's much. I don't get titles this big, so, you know, it felt kind of nice to get this one.
Yeah, so don't screw it up.
It's because you're bad at reviewing big games. Honesty is best policy. Get fucked. Okay, go ahead, continue on.
No. Fine, I will. Until you apologize.
Well, we're going to be here a while.
Well, we do have to fill up for time. All right, so anyway, so the SpongeBob game is essentially, like, it's a 3D platforming game. I mean, it's pretty much Spyro or Crash Bandicoot with SpongeBob characters put in there instead. And, you know, as the plot goes, like, Plankton has accidentally unleashed, like, this huge army of robots all over Bikini Bottom. And so it's up to Patrick, SpongeBob, and Sandy to take care of them all. And each one of them has their own powers. Like, SpongeBob has certain abilities. Like, he can roll up into a ball and go over certain areas or get into certain areas easier. He also has, like, a ground pound move that Sandy does not. Meanwhile, Sandy can fly through the air with her lasso, which is pretty fun. And her attacks aren't as powerful, but the lasso is handy as hell.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I was pretty surprised by that. And honestly, I prefer to play as Sandy, which is why I went for when we played multiplayer, but more on that later. And then Patrick can, like, throw stuff, and he has, like, a couple of other abilities, and it's just whatever. So, I mean, it's, like, it's a standard, as I said, it's, like, a standard, like, Spyro or Crash Bandicoot clone. You have to go around, and you collect golden spatulas, you collect, you know, all these, like, little shiny objects to unlock certain areas and make things available. You know, like,
yeah, this was originally a game released in, like, the golden era of character platformer games. And this was actually, wasn't this originally released under the old THQ Nordic banner or THQ banner?
That part I'm not sure about. I think it was.
I believe this was from the old THQ. Yeah. And now it's back home under THQ Nordic.
Right. And at the same time, like, I totally get why, you know, this game was beloved and why they took the time to make a remastered version of it. Like, honestly, it's a really freaking solid game. I was really surprised by it because most of the licensed games that you play are absolute crap. But, you know, minor issues here and there. Like, the gameplay is solid. The voice acting is pretty good. They don't have all of the voices from the cartoon show, but they got most of them. And it's just like, it looks really nice, and it's a blast to play. Like, I was really surprised by that. The only real downside that I have to it is that the difficulty, like, you know, you figure the target audience for this, you know, for this game, you know, for the SpongeBob thing is somewhere, like, kids somewhere between, like, 5 and 10. And honestly, like, the difficulty with it, I was a little surprised with it. I was even having some issues with that first boss, King Jellyfish. I mean, granted, you only have to hit him 3 times, but like the shots that he takes, I had to go through that level a bunch of times. Joe, did you have that similar issue, or are you just about to tell me that no, Jacob, you suck at video games and
you're just bad? I mean, I had some struggles, but not nearly to the level that you did. So I'm thinking maybe that your skills might be deteriorating a little bit quicker than mine.
Deteriorating? That's a nice way of you saying, Jacob, you've always sucked.
Hey, I'm trying to be nice. You're awful, and you've always been awful. You will always be awful. And it's proof that even a SpongeBob game is too difficult for you.
I concur.
Shut up, Cole. You didn't even see me play. Anyway. Okay,
don't need to. I already know you probably throw the sand because there's no rice.
There's no sand to throw. Joke's on you. It's fruit, though. So, yeah, there is fruit to throw around. But so, like, the difficulty with that, also the areas where, like, the boundaries are for certain things. I do appreciate that the game itself is fairly forgiving with it. You know, like the human hand from the SpongeBob cartoon will come out and rescue you if you go into an area that you're not supposed to. And the game doesn't penalize you for it either, which I was pleasantly surprised with. However, like in some of the platforming areas, it is like if you don't make that jump, like you end up having to go through almost the whole entire level again. And the checkpoint system is not exactly the best. So, I mean, there were some issues with it, but it's nothing like you couldn't redo. But I could see, like, again, the target audience getting really frustrated and be like, fuck this game. Even though they're 8 and shouldn't be knowing the word fuck, but, you know.
I feel like this is a game of two target audiences, where it's either 5 to 10-year-olds who love SpongeBob SquarePants or 30 to 40-year-olds who love SpongeBob SquarePants and marijuana.
No comment. I won't tell you which side of that I fit in.
Well, you're not 5, though.
Mentally?
And you like marijuana.
Excuse me, not in my good Christian suburbs. Nobody here better partake of the devil's lettuce.
The devil's lettuce. Oh, my Lord. Speaking of the devil, I wasn't a big fan of the new multiplayer mode.
Oh, God. That thing was horrendous. Like, the camera, first off, the camera sucked, and it was real hard to judge where exactly the island ended and the goo started. And so, like, it was real easy to lose a life just by being knocked off by a robot. But it was just like, it just wasn't fun.
No, like, the multiplayer mode is basically like an arena battle thing where you right. and a partner fend off robots, and then you move from island to island. Every 5 islands, you take a shot at, I don't know, it just
wasn't good. Like,
I appreciate that they tried to do something and add something new to the game, but I think this might have been one of those instances where if you just kept the single player game and didn't worry about trying to add anything on, it might have been a better experience.
Yeah. I mean, can you do more than two people in the multiplayer, or is it just two?
I'm not too sure. We did two players.
Right. Joe and I played it not too long ago. Yeah. I mean, it was
honestly, okay. I'm not going to go back to the multiplayer mode. It was a nice distraction for what it was, but I don't see myself finding the desire to go back and play that mode again. I would rather just go back and finish the story of the game.
Yeah, which I'm definitely going to be doing.
Yeah.
How much does the game cost?
$30. So for $30, what is your verdict on SpongeBob SquarePants Battle for Bikini Bottom Rehydrated?
Hell yeah. Honestly, $30. I think that's a pretty good price for this. As I said, it's a solid like 3D platformer. It has surprising depth for a licensed game. And I was pleasantly surprised with it. And if you're a fan of SpongeBob, you know, it's a not miss game. So yeah, I definitely recommend it, even for $30. And you know me, I'm cheap as hell.
Yeah, you are.
So the fact that I'm like, hell yeah, I'd spend $30 on this.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. Well, Jacob, we're going to let you get going. Cole and I have a party cast that we have to attend. So do you have any final words before we move on?
Well, seeing as I haven't listened to the podcast for like the last couple of weeks, did you guys talk about all those properties from Majesco being bought up?
Yes.
Did you discuss how much like I fangirled over?
I mentioned you being nuts about Advent Rising.
Okay, and us getting possibly getting a sequel, at least a remaster.
Take it one step at a time, Jacob.
Hey. Honestly, if we get a remaster of it on, you know, Xbox Series X, I'm going to bust a nut.
All right, moving on. Jacob's gone. It's party cast time. Chris and Purnell are here. How are you guys doing?
Hi.
Moon in a June in spring.
I hope this shit's working. Oh my God, I hope this shit's working. So, as we mentioned earlier in the show, I'm on my new computer, which is fun, and it's pretty, and it's fast, and it's giving us problems, so hopefully this show records, and it makes it out, and everyone can hear this. But in the meantime, how was your weekend? How are you guys doing? I got my new computer. Anything fun happen to you guys over the weekend?
No. If anything, my weekend was pretty shitty at the very end. It's, I can't even... It's never happened to me before. So best way to describe it is, for the most part, the weekend was going great. I watched a new TV show, played some video games, you know, typical shit. But Sunday night, I got a coronavirus negative test back, which was also good because I was freaking out about that at one point.
It's good to hear.
But yes, sir. But then the weird thing happened was on Sunday night, I went to the grocery store. And I'm leaning into this because I think this was the reasoning behind it. So I went to the grocery store to pick up chicken, to make some jerk chicken, marinate some jerk chicken. And they were having a sale on king crab claws. And I was like, oh, interesting. I'll buy some because everybody else is buying. It was like a whole line of people getting them. So I grabbed some, took them home, and I steamed them, ate them, and everything seemed cool. Watched some more TV, and around like 12:30, 1 in the morning, I was going to go to bed. And then for some reason, which I'm guessing is the crabs because I don't know where else it could have possibly been, it was like a knife was stabbing me in the throat. My throat wouldn't open up properly. That feeling when you try to expand your chest and it's like something stabbing at it, so you can't even expand your chest. And the way it got weirder still because also my back, I thought something like a disc had slipped in my back or something because it was like an excruciating pain. And like I couldn't bend my back in certain ways. It was the most bizarre pain. I couldn't even sleep that night. Like I tried to go to bed. And I'm just kind of tossing and turning all night. So I didn't even sleep. And the thing that makes it more complicated is that I don't have any health insurance right now because I just changed jobs. And the health insurance doesn't kick in for a little bit.
No, so
I'm in
this man.
Unfortunate limbo where I was like, I'm not going to the hospital until I really have to go. So that night, I got no sleep. The next day, I went to work, did all my stuff, recorded Rhythm and Pixels while still like this. And the thing about it was like I started getting better. So I was like, I don't think it's anything major. It has to be just like maybe something like the crabs didn't settle with my body. Maybe they were like bad, like almost like a form of food poisoning or something. I don't know. But it kept happening that way up until, believe it or not, like an hour or two ago. And I just kind of like randomly realized, whoa, I'm not having breathing problems. I'm not having weird like back cracking problems. But it was happening for a good like almost 2 days of just like constant pain and an inability to move properly and all this stuff. But I also couldn't stop. I had to keep doing my job. I went to work every day. Well, every day being 2 days. But I went to work. Still did fulfilled all my obligations, but I'm basically in the grocery store picking up stuff, and it's like, I can't bend my back. It sucked ass.
Damn.
But it seems like it's fucking over, and I could not explain for the life of me, what it was or what caused it or anything. But I'm just being mindful of that moment where I might take a breath, like a deep breath, and all of a sudden, like, it just stops short because now my throat's like, nope, stabbing. Like that. It's a sucky feeling because you can't explain it. You don't know how to mitigate it or anything.
So, you're almost as hot a mess as this show right now.
Damn right. I'm a hotter mess than this show. Hotter mess.
I have a semi-important question.
Yeah.
Do you have a gallbladder?
Nope. Got it removed because it had a polyp on it years ago.
Because what you're describing is what happened when my gallbladder shit the bed. I had a gallstone stuck in my common bile duct. Mm-hmm. And I went to the hospital because I was telling everybody that it felt like my chest and my back were wrapped in barbed wire. And that was like, holy fuck, I'm going to die. And literally I went in to the hospital and they put me in an ambulance and sent me to a better hospital.
That's like a Simpsons episode right there.
And they did emergency surgery, and the doctor the next morning, she was like, if you hadn't have come in last night, you wouldn't have come in tomorrow.
Holy Jeez. Shit. They got like that.
I was 5 weeks. Yeah. 5 weeks postpartum with number three when it happened.
Damn.
I just had her, and it was bad. I had got a stone had got stuck in my common bile duct and like cut it open. And so I was leaking fluids into my abdomen from my common bile duct.
Well, was this a situation where it was doing it for a while until eventually it was something that she felt?
Yeah. And throughout the whole pregnancy, basically it was just doing that.
Damn.
See, that sounds eerily close to what happened with mine. Although mine was a man-made issue where they took my gallbladder out and then they sliced open my liver and they sewed me back up and they let my liver sliced open with bile just pouring all over my insides.
Nope.
It was a similar scenario where like one day you were just like, what the hell? My body's killing me.
Oh no. This was like the day I was released. I was back that night.
Oh, well, at least that happened. Yeah. You weren't like trying to pass off. Cause you know, sometimes people will go home from a surgery. It's like, I guess this pain is normal. That's the recovery process. And it's like, no, actually it's not. And that's really fucking bad.
Yeah.
I'm the person that does shit like that. I'm the one that won't go back.
Yeah. I'm the guy that would have toughed it out thinking that was normal. And then that would have been the guy that didn't make it back the next day. Like, like my gallbladder came out because I went to the hospital, or not even the hospital, just the doctor in general for like a normal checkup. Or not, rephrase it. It wasn't a normal checkup. I was having stomach pain. Like I was like, I'm like stomach ache or something. And it turned out like those issues were like stress related, like general stress. Cause I was in a really weird time in my life. And, at the same time, the doctor was one of those doctors where he does like a gajillion tests when he can, because one, he's overly cautious, and two, insurance will pay him. So he's getting banked. so he just did a bunch of random tests just to speculate on stuff. So he's like, even though we determined your stomach pain was caused by X, while we were doing other stuff, we discovered why. Why being a polyp on my gallbladder. And I said, okay, what does that mean? He's like, nothing right now. I mean, it's just there. It is what it is. He's like, it's something we just have to monitor. And I said, what are you monitoring it for? He's like, it could become cancerous if it goes out, if it gets a little out of control, essentially. And he was like, we can monitor it every 6 months and see what happens. I was like, okay. So what happens if I come in on month six, you find no cancer? Month seven, it becomes cancerous, and I show up on month 12, and it's had 5 months to fester. Mm-hmm. He was like, that's what would happen. I was like, take this fucker out. So he's take it out. He's like, what? I was like, I don't need it. Get it out of my body. If that's the chance, if that's the risk I'm taking, I don't need it. And then, of course, they were like, well, you know, you won't be eating spicy foods. And I was like, fuck you, all you I want. And I still eat spicy
food. I eat spicy food. I don't give a fuck.
I will admit, I do definitely think my level of heat tolerance went down a bit, but I ain't stopping.
I suffer from my transgressions. I just didn't stop.
Oh, yeah. I think that's the best thing about spicy, because I've talked to people that's like, why do you do it? It's so painful. I'm like, the pain is life. What are you talking about? That's why you do it. The trick is to find a sauce that's just the right amount of heat, where you're kind of suffering, but you're not dying for it. And if it's got a flavor,
the pain is life. That doesn't sound healthy.
It's true.
Great. It's the truth. It's like it releases endorphins. Like if you've ever sat down and like got some wings where they just kind of increased in levels of heat, like bit by bit, and you kind of eat one at a time, going up in intensity until you hit that wall where you're like, fuck, this fucking hurts. I'm done. Then that means the wing right below it is your level that you want to eat all the time, because it was hot enough to make you go, oh, I'm kind of sweating in here. This is rough, but it wasn't painful. And your body felt like it felt something. You felt something. You felt a rush while you ate. It's hard to convey to people who don't eat spicy foods, but it's a feeling I don't want to go away. I love spicy foods and I eat them all the time for that exact reason. And if I can get a flavor out of it, all the better.
See, I tried to explain that to Wingstop, and they were like, you only get two flavors.
You got mild and hot.
Yeah.
Like, so you're like, telling me I need
10 different wings and 10 different intensities. Doing something. Like, sir, please.
This is a Wendy's.
Yeah.
Sir, this is a Wendy's. Which reminds us, you want to try our new Wendy's hot wings? Yeah, shit.
Wendy's spicy nugs.
Honestly, the fact that they don't have those baffles me a little. You would think
they were limited time only.
Oh, were they?
Wait, they actually did have sauced wings at
oh, not sauced. No, wings.
No, they had spicy nuggets.
Oh yeah, I wasn't talking about that. I'm familiar
you
with that.
You still get the spicy ones here. I know that for a fact because number one got some last week.
I'm saying
those weren't spicy.
I'm saying they serve nuggets. They have dipping sauces for nuggets. They know that buffalo wings are big. They could easily take the buffalo sauce, they package in a cup, add a little more cayenne to it, toss the nuggets in it, and call it a new product, and it would sell like gangbusters. Guaranteed.
You can just order nuggets and sauce and do it yourself.
Yes, but then by that logic, think of all the burgers they come up with and claim it's a new burger, when really they just added one more strip of bacon. Like, the Baconator. You like the Baconator? This is the Bacon Buster.
In,
another strip. Yeah, we get it.
Right around 20 years ago, Jack in the Box had a bacon cheeseburger where it was just standard, you know, mayonnaise, burger, cheese, bacon, lettuce, and tomato. That's it. But they added a scoop of bacon bits to the bottom bun, like the same bacon bits they put in everything else, like, you know, the cheese wedges, whatever. And they called it the bacon cheeseburger.
Boom. New burger, and people probably lined up that shit.
It was actually my favorite burger for a while, too.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. If the burger's there, I'm going to order it because I want more bacon on my sandwich. But that's the point. People will actually go, so this is a bacon burger, but there's more bacon bits in it? Get shit. Give me two. Like, people do that. And these restaurants do it all the time. Like, I joke about it a lot. Like, when I usually talk about in regards to pizza, though. Like, the idea, like, when there was this period where they were trying to innovate pizza, like, new pieces. But they would never truly go a distance with it. They would never truly experiment. So it was always dumb shit, like, now with more pepperoni. Or we took a sausage, and then we took another sausage and put it on the pizza. Like, but you already do that. Yeah, but this time we told you we did it. Or, okay, now we put the cheese inside the crust. Yeah, but the cheese was already on top of the crust. So it's not really a new pizza. It's just more cheese.
Are you shit-talking stuffed crust pizza? Because if you're shit-talking stuffed crust pizza, we're going to have a fight.
No, quite the contrary. It's not shit-talking. It's cool. But that's just it, though. It's really just the cheese they already use placed somewhere else on the pizza. But is it really new, or is it just another place they shove the cheese?
Stuffed crust is totally new.
No, it's not. It was just more cheese, and I liked it. But honestly, it's not innovation. It's like, I want experimental taste, new flavors. They said, we ain't doing that shit. Here's some more cheese. It's almost like they quoted like Coca-Cola, how we were like, man, Japan gets like freaking rose hip cola and cucumber cola.
Oh, what you should see their pizzas.
That was more. Yeah, they get weird pieces too. What do we get now with more carbonation?
I can do without like pizza that's like white sauce, broccoli florets, corn, and then like little
hold up.
Little hot dog wings.
I gotta stop you here because you got a little off the track, but I will tell you that one of the best pizzas that is fucking amazing is garlic cream sauce with spinach and ricotta cheese. That's
yes, that would be delicious.
Spinach, I like.
Potato slices on there too. I bet you love it if you eat potatoes, that is.
Yeah.
Potato slices on top, put it in the oven. Make sure they're not like just fresh potatoes. You want to make them soppy before you do it. But God, that would be so good. Mm-hmm. Also, pesto sauce on the pizza instead of tomato sauce. Banging. But like to me, those are like those would be considered innovations more or less. And to this day, very few pizza places will even do a pizza that doesn't have a sauce beyond red and white. Like they just won't. Like to me, that is true innovation on a food thing. That would be a risky venture to say, if people like this, we're going to make money. But if they don't, we'll have to just not make it anymore. Oh, no. But instead, we get now with more sausage. We took an extra meat, but this time it's from Canada. And we put it on the pizza. You thought you liked bacon? What if it's from Canada? Oh, shit. Like that's it always drives me nuts, and I have friends over. Like a friend of mine posted a photo. Korea has green onion checks. Like to me, on one hand, it doesn't sound appealing to me, but would I try it? You bet your ass, I'd taste that.
I mean, the very best snack food in the world is Chex baked in an oven with Worcestershire sauce and butter.
Yeah, Chex mix, right? Yeah, so
exactly.
It's like,
yeah, that's Chex mix.
So the idea of like a green onion Chex is like, it just seems like it could work. My brain doesn't gravitate towards wanting it, but if it existed here, I would try it, and I bet it could work.
No, you lost me with the word onion.
I don't like onions, but I'm okay with green onions. That's the only onion I'll eat.
If it was any other cereal, I would say no, but Chex just somehow works with savory. I don't know.
Green dropping Lucky Charms.
I'm dropping a picture I took of a Pizza Hut menu board in Japan into the chat, so you can take a look at some innovations. There's some banana stuff in there. So if you ever get to visit Japan, this is what you might end up liking. I don't know, but like I said, broccoli florets, lots of fish. They do a few pizzas where they put little smokies, basically, like hot dog weenies in the crust.
Ooh.
And now we're talking. They also like to do their pizzas in quadrants instead of halves. So, like, you know, every two slices is a whole different pizza.
No.
It's just...
I would consume any of those things. He's like, that works. I would do that.
Yeah, but, I mean, I don't, you know, you probably, I don't know if you know the yen exchange rate, but a lot of those pizzas are, like, starting at $25.
Hey, you got to pay for innovation.
I mean, yeah, I guess so.
We can always come back home to like now with one more strip of bacon on your burger.
Yeah, but like a lot of the more popular things to put on pizza over there is like mayonnaise and like corn and things like that. So
yeah, Japan looks like I think it actually made me think mayo could work too, but there has to be spicy mayo. Like I
yeah, there's some mayos I like. I never liked just standard Hellman's. Unless it's on the right thing, but you know, I'm from Texas. I'm a mustard guy.
I didn't realize Texas was known for mustard. Or
yeah, I think our palate is tart. Like we like tart and you know, very savory. So like, yeah, a lot of the burger places, if it's a Texas burger, quote unquote, it's usually got mustard by default and pickles.
Mm.
Like to start, but yeah.
Speaking of starting, we should probably get started with the reviews.
he was holding out for the proper segue. Like, you know, speaking of,
I was so excited because
bacon on a burger.
I was so excited because there's only four reviews for us to do for the rest of the show. Right.
And 15
I was
like, minute podcast, y'all.
Yeah, this is going to be really quick. This is going to be nice and quick. And you know, we're going to get it done and in and out. And I'm going to go back to sleep real soon. And now 20 minutes of talking about weird fucking foods. And here we are.
Delicious.
Yeah. Well, so, we'll make it reviews. Y'all ready?
We'll make it spicy.
All right, next game to talk about tonight is called 1971 Project Helios, developed and published by Rico Technology, released June 9th on Xbox One for $39.99, turn-based strategy game which combines military tactics and close combat. In a frozen world, eight characters have to join forces in a journey to find Dr. Margaret Blythe, their last hope. Purnell, tell us about 1971 Project Helios.
So Project Helios takes place across a series of chapters, so to speak. And with those chapters, what happens is that the game will kind of just kind of give you a set of characters. Sometimes a group, basically it starts out with different groups of characters between the chapters, but then eventually they all come together for the purpose of the narrative and their common goal. But as you play the game, what happens is the game, they will set you up with your group of people. They will give you a mission, and then you'll kind of be on a map where you're walking around. So if you've got a party of three members, they'll all just be walking together, and you'll control them with the left thumbstick. And as you progress across the map, you'll eventually come across a point where enemies will just kind of be posted up in positions. And when you get into that zone, you go into a battle scenario. And what happens then is that the characters kind of take position. They're predetermined, so you don't really tell them where to go. They just go to where they're going to start. And then you have to battle it out. And you can't leave that environment until you defeat all the opponents. Now, the way combat works is that every character gets two skill points per round. And then with those skill points, they can do one of four actions. They have a basic move action. They have a basic attack action, which will either be a melee attack or distance firearm attack. And then two special skills that varies by character. But they range in things such as like Overwatch, which is if an enemy goes within their moves within their line of sight, they'll fire off a volley at them. There can be things like, you know, cover, which will boost your defense and position. Push, where you can push people out of the way or into the way rather, and stuff like that. Now, every time you use one, you drain a skill point or skill point, and then when you've used them both up, that character can't move anymore. Now, the thing about it that's interesting about this game is that if you make a mistake in combat or multiple mistakes, you can always just flat out restart the combat situation and take another crack at it, which is kind of nice in the sense of like you don't have to feel as stressed out if you make a mistake or something along those lines. Now, in addition to what I already described about how characters interact and such, there's also a cover system where depending on how low or high that the cover environment is, you'll either get a half cover bonus, which means that enemy attacks have a 50% chance of missing you, and same applies for them shooting at them, or 100% where they just can't shoot at you from that angle. It just can't get through to you. So you'll be moving for that kind of stuff. But in addition, there's also some added elements that don't come into play until a little later in the game. There is something called I'm probably mispronouncing it, but it's like Fulgor system. And Fulgor is an environmental currency that you can gain from like locating Fulgor producing items on the map as you're exploring it. And it's a currency that allows you to do two different things. One, if a character dies in combat and you have someone with the ability to resurrect characters, you can spend Fulgor to resurrect the fallen character. If you do not have any Fulgor and a character dies, it's a game over and you have to restart the battle or restart the entire stage. The other thing Fulgor can be used as a currency for is to reduce cooldowns on a skills. So let's say, for example, you decide you want to use the adrenaline. Adrenaline is a skill which allows you to kind of dash like up to 15 tiles, whereas normally you cannot dash that far. If it takes three turns for it to cool down, so you can use it again. But you can spend some Fulgor to hasten its use again, its ability to be used again, so you can kind of spam it. But of course, Fulgor is not exactly the easiest resource to come across, and it's so important across the board that you don't want to necessarily go through it on that level. And one other thing I forgot to mention that does, so I should have said three things Polgor does, is as an added element in the game, when you're in the more cold environments, your characters also take frostbite damage just from being out in the cold on turns. And you just lose hit points for being cold. What ends up happening is you can spend some Polgor to gain some hit points back. It's almost like it warms you up a little bit, essentially. So between those three different things, you're going to be kind of conserving this stuff. And after each stage, when you're done, you get options to do a few things because you go back to something called a campfire. At the campfire, you can spend time listening to conversations or, correction, reading conversations because there are no voices in this game. Or you can review enemy stats or ability types because for every enemy you fight, you can review what their hit point level is, what attacks they have, and things of that nature. So you can kind of say, kind of plan out what enemies you're going to possibly deal with and how they function. Though, suckily, I said that, I don't think that's even a word. Suckily, you can't utilize that knowledge on the field itself. So it's like you're reading it at the campfire for like intel, but once you're out and about, if you forgot how a certain enemy type works, too bad. You just got to wing it and hope you can just kind of play it by ear. And the last thing you can do, which is something you also unlock a little later in the game, is you can upgrade attacks and skills. So, like say, for example, you might have your default melee attack, your default weapon attack. If you find certain items out in the field while you're walking around, you can use those items as required by a particular character to improve their basic attack or to learn a new skill on their very limited but still effective skill trees. And if you learn a new skill, you can replace one of the two special skills that I mentioned earlier with their newly purchased skill. So it gives you a small bit of customization to what you want the other characters to do and not necessarily just be based on how their default loadout is when you get them in the game. So the game as a whole, how do I describe this? Because it's not a bad game at all. Like it functions, and I did enjoy bits of what I played, but it does have some negatives too. Most particularly the fact that this is one of those weird cases where the narrative just didn't grab me. From the very beginning of the game, I was kind of struggling to feel much of any concern for the characters or for their identities even. Like, I don't know if it's because of the writing or if it's because of just the way it flowed, but I never found myself going, "Oh no, Hannah, what are you going to do?" It was just more like, I'm time into the game, like, what is Hannah again? Like, it was that sort of situation where I was like, it just ultimately became, okay, which character has the grenades and which character has the adrenaline? Like, that kind of thing. And then the other element is the fact that this is a plus and minus at the same time, is that the skirmishes are always on very small atmosphere, very small areas. So what happens with that is you show up on one zone for battle. The game determines where it wants your guys to start out at. There is no, you know, like how Final Fantasy Assassins or something like that, where you could say, "I want my guys to go here, 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 and here." Yeah. This game says, no, they're going to go right here every time. And then from there, you're like, okay, I got to kill these dudes. But since the environment is so small, you're pretty much already within range to do what you're going to do for the most part. Like, you may occasionally try to go find some cover. Like, you might start in a situation where everybody's kind of exposed. You're going to die for cover. But for the most part, everybody's really close together. So abilities like Overwatch might not even necessarily have use because the enemies may already be in positions to attack you from the very start. So it's like, where are they going to run to? They're already set up. And stuff like that. So like, ultimately, what you end up finding yourself doing sometimes is just like, okay, I need to optimize my kills here and just straight up from where I start the battle, just kill everybody. The last thing, I guess there is one more thing, but that's part of the game's design, but still worth mentioning, is the aforementioned 50% and 100% cover system. So, for those who are already non-fond of like RNG in their games, the fact that you're in a skirmish and just by virtue where the enemy is standing at, and nothing else, you find that your attacks have a 50% chance of missing, that'll become annoying very fast when every shot counts. And yeah, that does work with the enemies as well. I mean, like, if you're behind cover, they get a 50% chance of missing. But still, like, it's like if you've played Pokemon and you get an attack that has a 60% chance of hitting, you never use it. Because 60% is pretty shitty. but in that regard, though, you come into this game knowing that it will be very likely that you're going to be having a lot of scenarios where you're like, if I don't get this shot, I'm just going to restart the skirmish because fuck that. but nonetheless, with all that stuff said, I enjoy what I played of the game. It's just the difficulty in the full recommendation comes in the fact that when it comes down to competition, including the game I mentioned very last week, even, which is a real-time strategy, but still, it's a steep competition for this type of game. But if you're talking about it in its own universe outside of the competition, I think the game can still be a good time and an enjoyable one. The frostbite mechanic is fairly unique to this style of gameplay, and the fact that resurrections are done by way of Fulgore is an interesting concept too, because it's not a resource like, you know, stockpiling items you bought at a store. It's more just like, if you found a thing on the map that gives you some, that's a very valuable resource. Don't squander it on things like death if you can help it. So in that regard, like, there are definitely things that this game does I think are cool. It's just that story hit, the lack of interest I had in the story and those small skirmish spaces became a bit of a problem to the point where I was like, yeah, I could play something else if I had access to it. But if I would say if you could get this game on like a fairly decent sale, I think it would be a solid try at that point for sure. But at the 40, it's a harder recommendation in that regard. So I would say try it on sale.
Sounds good. Makes sense to me. I had fun with it as well. It's hard. I had a really hard time getting far in the game. It seems really unforgiving, and the AI just does really good at ganging up on your party members and just wiping them out.
The one perk that you have to that, which I ended up learning later on in the game, is two folders. One, just the general state of being able to just retry until you get it right.
Yeah.
But then the other part is that if you can get a decent meat shield out there, which keep in mind, it's only about as determined as when the game gives them to you and eventually giving guys cover. But you can get a decent meat shield out there. And if they're in the right position, the enemies might just straight up zoom in on them and try to take them out. And if you can boost their defense up enough and get them behind decent cover sometimes, you might be able to just sponge damage with the one guy and then just kind of bum rush them with the rest.
Yeah.
But I do still agree with you, though, in the fact that the game is not very forgiving at all. It can be real dickish.
All right. Well, next game to talk about is called Grimshade, developed by Tail Rock, published by UTC Asterion, released June 25th on the Switch for $24.99. Lead a group of adventurers on a journey and explore a varied and intricate world, meet new characters, and reveal plot-related secrets. Remember, beauty is deceptive. Danger lurks everywhere. Test your skills in challenging turn-based battles, adjusting your combat tactics and optimal team combinations for each foe you meet on the way. Chris, tell us about Grimshade.
Okay, Grimshade. Well, I was interested in this game because I like that the character that they use on the icon is a badger with a gun. And so you're familiar with the like over 100 years old book, The Wind in the Willows, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a character called Badger in it. And at some point he does have a gun. And there is a Rankin Bass 80s animated film that I actually have on DVD that looks where he looks just like this character, but I'm like, they couldn't have used that as a source. It's too obscure. But I thought that was kind of cool personally as a blast from the past kind of thing. I was like, oh good, I get to play as Badger. And then I get into this game and I find out that it's basically like sort of steampunk aesthetic a little bit. And, you know, of course, part of that is going to be anthropomorphic animals, you know, kind of hanging out with humans, which is, you know, a long standing tradition that we all love in JRPGs like Breath of Fire, Suikoden, things like that. But in this one, they're kind of like a stand in. They're a stand in for like racism problems. So if you called this character a badger, then that's not politically correct. they have their own words for it that I've already forgotten. ARLs or something like that. Anyways, that's getting ahead of myself a little bit. So Grimshade is an RPG. it's a little hard to place in like an exact subgenre of that. It's not quite a JRPG. It's kind of menu based, but it is turn based, and it's basically where you know, you run around in isometric areas, talk to people, and you know, there's lots of plot. You find out what's going on, characters meet each other, and then you get into battle, and the battle, I think the game that I could most closely compare it to, very favorably, that is to say, like, maybe even giving this game too much credit, is like the Mega Man Battle Network type of games.
Oh,
so you got two grids. The enemy's on the right, your characters are on the left, and you position your characters in a way that you are going to, you know, keep your vanguard characters towards the front. You want to keep your your long range characters near the back, but you also want to put them directly behind the vanguard character, because the vanguard character is going to absorb damage for them, which is a pretty cool thing. And so your starting team at the early game is, you know, said whatever he's called, but you know, we in the world, we on the outside world that can call him a badger. He's a badger. This right. Literary character, a beloved literary character, Charlie, that's his name. I had to remember. It's actually this like weird spelling name, but he goes by Charlie. Anyways, so like he's a sniper type character. So he stands behind the hero, whose name also escapes me. He's a dude. And then Kiba, who's kind of like the magic user. He's actually an interesting character. He has no defenses whatsoever. So he has to like be behind somebody. And, you know, like I said, typically it's going to be your heavy and then your shot guy and then your magic guy. And so basically, every time, like, you know, turn orders come up, and as soon as your turn comes up, you choose your action, and the different actions that you choose, like, both your main character and Charlie have like two weapons, and you can choose between them. One has, you know, Charlie has two different kinds of guns. Other dude has a sword and a gun, and depending on which one you choose is going to determine when your next turn is going to come up. And some of them have delayed moves where as long as the enemy doesn't get to stop you, you can plan on doing like a really devastating shot. And then, you know, so it's kind of like this thing of like strategically trying to figure out what you can do and in what order. And then your magic user guy. So they have this system called tension, where when you're hit or when you get hit, it raises your tension up to a certain level. And if your tension goes up too high, then you kind of have a breakdown and you have to wait a couple of turns for that character to be able to act again. So you kind of have to manage that, too. And your magic character is interesting because his moves are, he has this like light magic that he can do. Like he has a status magic that, you know, heals your characters, or he has an attack that can attack the enemy. And then when his tension gets over 50%, it switches to dark, where he has a thing that will inflict status effects, and he has a dark elemental magic thing. And if you can get him where you're kind of juxtaposing between the two, like you're able to, you know, use the light magic, and then your tension goes over, boils over to 50%, and you can then use dark magic, it lets you use it immediately, so you can actually plan on him doing double damage if you're good. So
it's that's like cool.
Yeah, it's cool strategic stuff like that. And you know, like I said, story's interesting. It's about a we don't know, but there's this kid in yellow cargo pants. That's actually his name until he's named. You know, Kiba, who's the magic user, who is basically some kind of failed experiment by this scientist, this transparently evil scientist guy, who's like, you know, the power goes out in his lab, so he assumes that this kid in a tube has died, and so he says, dump him in the lake with the others or whatever. And then you play as the hero, who's like kind of fighting against this encroaching force that is like trying to take over his city, and he ends up crashing into said lake or the shore of such, and he runs into this dead, this, you know, gruesome scene of like all these dead bodies of guys wearing yellow cargo pants. And among them is this still living kid who has no memory of who he is or what he can do. And, you know, he can use powerful magic stuff without the aid of technology, because this game, you can do magic, but you need technology. So it's like it's trying to unravel that mystery. It's trying to also protect your hometown from the forces that are still attacking. And, you know, like things are moving. Like it's a good story that, you know, gets heavy early on and, you know, gets you interested and involved. You know, because there's these other thief type characters that are up to no good and you have to fight them periodically too and all this other good stuff. So that's the good in this game. Also, backgrounds are gorgeous. They're very, they're hand-drawn and they look really good. However, that's a perfect time to switch over into the stuff I didn't like. I'm going to send a picture into chat. So while the characters look good, the backgrounds look great, and the battle systems look really good too. They're kind of cel shaded, and like I said, it's cartoony. So, but it's a good like mixture of cartoony cel shaded characters against, you know, somewhat realistic but painted backgrounds. When you talk to people, they have character portraits that seem to have been drawn by a completely different person or something. So I've inserted into chat a picture of the guy in the yellow cargo pants, who, again, is your magic user, and his face is just the derpiest.
Wow.
Yeah, you're looking at that, right? I don't know if you can put it into chat or anything.
No, I can't put it into chat right now, but I can use that as the episode image.
Okay, something like that. Anyways, all the human characters look like that kind of style of, like, just not great at all. However, all the animals look fine. I dare I say stately. I want to say maybe the artist is a furry who hasn't drawn humans before. That's a total conjecture on my part. But
you never know.
But yeah, that's the thing. It really undercuts the dramatic element of this game, and there is a lot of dramatic element in this game. Okay, so that's one. The other is that, so if you leave the tutorials on, which in the game's many, many loading screens, it will tell you that you have the option to turn them off. They kind of joke, though, that you shouldn't. They kind of teach you, like, everything about the menu system, the sub-menus, the battle menus. It's all a crock of nonsense. I have not been able to figure out, like, the battle system or the menu system. Like, it tried to explain to me how to put healing items into, like, my battle party thing in a tutorial where they forced me to use some of my hard-earned, like, money to purchase ingredients and craft this, like, this beverage for Charlie so that he could shoot better. And then I made the thing and then immediately got into a battle where it was like, okay, now use the thing. And even though it held my hand through every other interaction, it did not tell me how to do this. So I just won the battle anyway, just kind of ignored it. And now I still don't know how to put that stuff in. And the game has like this crafting system. It's, you don't level up conventionally, which I have a love-hate thing with that. I like to just level up after battles and distribute stat points or something. This game has you gathering crafting materials and then upgrading your weapon to make yourself better. And, you know, I haven't even gotten to the tutorial for that. And I've literally, so the game records every tutorial that it makes you go through. At the spot I'm in the game right now, I have 49 tutorials.
Jesus.
Feature length. Yeah. And like I said, I still haven't gotten to where I can improve my actual character. And I'll tell you why. This is another element of the game. It friggin' crashes all the time.
Damn.
And in fact, I am currently in a storyline battle that I have not been able to win yet because the game will crash halfway through that battle. It's happened 5 times. I did it 2 more times while doing this review.
Jeez.
So this game is actually broken. I'm not sure if there's anything I could do differently, but I looked around and looked at reviews of the Steam release of the game, and they've reported pretty much the same, that they've been updating and fixing it since, you know, it was released prior to the Switch release. And now the Switch release has been out for 5 days and there's no sign of a 1.1 or anything. It's still on, you know, just 1.0.
No.
So I don't know what to say about this one because I can't get far enough in it to learn the other half of what you can do in the game. And the first half of it was just like incomprehensible to me, but it's frustrating because everything else about this game is fine.
Except some portraits. Of the portraits, yeah.
Yeah, character portraits notwithstanding. I like the story. I like where it's going. I like the high drama. I like the mystery. I like the art. The music's pretty good. It's very, very dramatic music, but lovely. The title screen especially has this nice piano song that, you know, you'll be definitely wanting to listen to. And, you know, I guess the other thing, and this might go along with the brokenness, is that there's load screens everywhere and they're very long, including, you know, the game itself, like before you even get to the title screen, it like has the crawling bar. And I don't know, something about the crawling bar before you see the title screen is always a bummer to me.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Wanted to like this game a lot, but there's some work that needs to be done on this thing before I can recommend it.
All right. Well, if a patch comes along, we'll take another look at this one, but it sounds like in the meantime, this one you might be better off holding off on.
Yeah, I'm going to say at its 1.0 status right now, and until we hear from the developer, it's definitely a deny it.
All right.
And I would say once it gets fixed, it's a try it. Because of the menu system and just like, you know, there's some other things about it too that, like, you know, typos and bad sentence structures and things like that. But all of that is kind of like, overshadowed by the fact that I can't get it to work past a certain battle in the storyline.
No.
So if it, yeah, I'll gladly update my review on this if they get it fixed, but yeah, just avoid for now.
Sounds good. All right, next game to talk about is A Summer with the Shiba Inu, developed by Quill Studios, published by Radleika Games. It released June 23rd on PS4, 24th on Xbox, 26th on the Switch for $9.99. When Sid the Shiba Inu returns to Shiba Island after a 10-year absence, she sets off a chain of events that overturns the lives of all the dogs she had left behind. Cole, Purnell, the both of you, check this one out. Who wants to start?
Coltrane, get an
Damn it. Why did I get thrown in like that? Damn.
Because I reviewed Project Helios. Got it.
Ah, that's rude. So A Summer with a Shiba Inu is a visual novel from Radleika. And so you can already deduce a couple of things about it. It's not exactly going to be top tier visual novel quality. And it's also going to be a stupid easy completion on Xbox. This one doesn't let you down. It is what it is. I have a few problems with A Summer with Shiba Inu's art, because that's a big part of visual novels, obviously. And they really took the cheap route for this game. I do want to give it props before I start to shred it for how it looks. I want to give it props that there are 70,000 words in this game.
Wow.
If you are into visual novels and you want some fuck ton of reading about some really weird shit where dogs live in a dystopian futuristic society where they have an actual capitalist hierarchy and are forced to fight in AR arenas, literally ARINAs, then to gain status in the society so that they can become top dog, it's gonna, like, make your heart overflow, because that's literally all this shit is. It's a little wild, and it's just, the more I played it, the more I was like, I have no idea what kind of hell I've descended into. However, if you want it to have a whole lot of story and look good, okay, now you're biting off more than you can chew. It kind of looks like, they've taken pictures of different dog breeds, cut out around them, cut out some random pictures of clothes, and like layered everything on top of a generic background. And then they've run it through an app to make it look like it was painted.
Interesting deduction.
Huh?
That's an interesting deduction. I didn't even think about it from that perspective. Yeah, but that I can see that.
Yeah, because I you know, being a digital artist, I can see when digital painting techniques have been used. And this is definitely looking like it was run through an app. If somebody painted these and I'm wrong, I'm horribly sorry. You did really good with the realism quality, but it definitely looks like it was run through an app.
Yeah, it does.
And it's very jankily cut out. I don't know if jankily is the word it is now, but like everything is just very rough around the edges. They didn't make any real efforts to smooth it. It was definitely not like illustrated with smooth line art or anything like that. And that's kind of disappointing because we have seen other visual novels published by Radelica, and granted they're developed by other developers, and this is the developer's first game at all. So I want to like encourage them, but still be honest about what you're getting out of it. Don't ever give up just because I think you have bad art, by all means. But you know, if you're throwing your money at it and you're expecting it to be visually pleasing, you may realize that there are some things that are going to stand out and just look bad.
Fernell, any thoughts on your end?
Well, one thing, the main thing that I found pretty humorous about this game is that it's hard. I mean, as I play, I find myself in these weird situations where, like, aside from just the novelty of all the characters being dogs, I kind of find myself constantly being taken out of the narrative, because the narrative is actually not half bad. But I find myself getting pulled out of the narrative because I'm constantly thinking about the fact that they're all dogs. And what I mean by that is it's not so much like, oh, look how cute they are. But I mean, like, they do stuff and they describe actions in a way that all I can come across is like, a dog couldn't do that. Yeah, a dog can't do that. They were at a restaurant early in the game and they described the food they were eating, which was crepes. And they described the process of cooking a crepe. And I'm sitting there thinking this would have been a good opportunity to describe how a dog could cook a crepe, because there's no way a dog could cook a crepe like they just described it. They don't have thumbs. They do not have thumbs, opposable thumbs. So grabbing a spatula and flipping eggs and shredding broccoli to put it, they can't do it.
And those kind of things, like, the art kind of throws that off too, because if they were drawn in like a furry style, you'd be like, okay, fine. It's if it was anthropomorphic in any kind of way whatsoever, you'd be like, I can suck it up a little bit. But they look like normal dogs run through paint filters, so you're like, I can't get on board with this.
How did that dog put on that cool biker's jacket? I don't understand.
Dogs can wear cool biker jackets.
They can with an owner to put it on them.
Exactly. They're not going to just put it on. And then they'll describe other things like, you know, dog reaches into bag and pulls out thing, or dog brings up wrist phone. Like, it's a dog. I've seen dogs lick their paws and they're not holding the paw up in the air in a way that can simulate, you know, I'm talking on a wrist phone. Woof, woof, woof. Now, obviously, that's not a detriment to the game. I mean, the charm of the game is the fact that it is dogs on a screen while they do this otherwise fairly, you know, like, just standard plot line. I mean, this could have been done with humans just as well as dogs. Mm-hmm. But the dogs are a novelty. That's why they did it. But as such, being me, who's always hyper into like the specifics of a narrative and the specifics of how things get done, I just can't help but be like, what the heck? That dogs can't do that. Dogs can't do that. And the worst part is, at the very first action the game described was very dog-like. You know, they had to open a door with a doorknob. They talked about how doorknobs got phased out. And then the dog had to sit on his hind legs and then use the two front paws to turn the doorknob. See, it's like, that's how a dog would open a doorknob door. But really, a dog wouldn't even do that because a dog wouldn't know how to do that shit. But I digress. These are talking dogs. The game honestly in and of itself works. I'm entertained by in the dialogue sense, and the fact that to be a game about a bunch of dogs, it's got a surprisingly sci-fi-esque plot to it. Mm-hmm. So
it's very young adult dystopian.
Yeah, like I was not expecting that when Joe was like, "You want to just play this game to review with Cole?" I'm like, "It's got dogs in it." But apparently it's got dogs with magic pendants and freaking battle arenas and mess. And it's crazy. But honestly, I will say I was entertained by it. As far as visual novels go, it's entertaining.
I want to point out that there are quite a few options for adjusting the speed of the text. And I always appreciate that the text is mostly legible. There are some times where the backgrounds behind it, you're a little like, okay, that's kind of rough. It could be a thicker font. But in general, it's pretty, you know, easy to read. And you have quite a few options for, you know, speeding it up, slowing it down, or skipping if you've already seen it. No complaints in that regard. If you only care about getting the completion, you can just like hammer the skip button and set it to auto skip everything except for your choices and be like, ta-da, I'm done. easy peasy. But, you know, I recommend when it comes to these visual novels, I think the stories in them are creative in a way that, yeah, it's not always like the most sensical, but they get to take risks that a lot of games don't get to take. Like, how many games are going to have a story about dogs fighting in a cyber arena for clout? You know?
True.
Fucking none. So you kind of just get to enjoy it for a little while. And, you know, sit back, put your feet up. I recommend at least one. Sometimes two playthroughs are pretty solid. I think there are 6 different endings.
Wow.
If I remember correctly. So, you know, I mean, there's plenty to keep you coming back. Like I said, 70,000 words. You're going to have, you know, some stuff to sit and scroll through. And I think there's huge value to these games that get lost because in the Western market over here, we're like, oh, give me something that goes pew-pew and constant action and I need to move and kill things. And you're like, sometimes.
Says the Call of Duty addict.
Yeah, you know.
But you also got to remember that some of those 70,000 words are going to be an intricate method to cook crepes, so
yeah.
it goes both ways.
You might learn to cook crepes like a dog and not even know that was a thing you wanted to learn. But
well, then crepe lessons aside, $10 on this one. What did the two of you think?
Was strawberry vinegar that expensive? I don't remember that one being that expensive.
I think it was yeah. It? I think so.
$10, given how bad the art is kind of a tougher sell.
I don't think the art's that horrible, though, but I'm not an art snob.
So. I'm not either, but you saw what I had to deal with.
Chris, go look at it. The stuff you dealt with is better.
No, I think Shiba Inu looks better than...
That's because you're biased that it's animals.
No, it doesn't have cats.
So?
Animals are a good bias to have, though. Let's be real here.
I'm looking at it. It's not great.
No, it's not great, but it's not Kiba bad.
I don't know what Kiba is, but that sounds real bad.
I'm going to roll with it, try it, because I don't want to be all like, oh, yeah, buy it for $10, because there are better Rattalaika titles, even better visual novel Rattalaikas at that price point. So, you know, if it were a couple dollars cheaper, if it were on sale, I'd feel a little differently. But I think it's just more of a try it than a buy it, given that it's just so odd that not everybody's going to jump into it. And then it's really kind of off-putting if you're snobby at all about art like I am, then you're going to just kind of turn your nose up. But yeah. Hey, if you only give a fuck about quick completions, then hit RB, hit A a couple times and call it a day.
All right. Well, we got one final game to talk about tonight. That is called Infini, developed by Barnacue, published by Nakana.io, released July 3rd on the Switch for $12. Lose yourself in infinity, but never lose hope. Think outside the box in a multiverse of perspective shifting puzzles. Chris, tell us about this one.
Oh, boy, can I? I mean, it's tough. Okay, so I actually need to look for... What was that one weird art game that I looked at, like, a while ago?
I don't know.
I know. I wish I could remember, but it had such a strange title that I don't really remember it. And, of course, I'm never going to find it in my...
Your sea of Switch games.
My sea of Switch games. No, I found it. War Room. Yeah. So, like, you know, that was just the game where you just clicked on stuff and just moved on to the next room, but it was just all this weird, surreal art.
Okay.
Well, this is a little bit like that, except there's actual gameplay. So, this is a game where you play... it's not clearly explained who or what you are. Maybe that's something you find out like towards the end of the game or something. It does, because it does have storyline, but just for the purposes of description, like, you are basically a badly drawn naked man.
Okay.
And you are following continuously through space. So the way that, and also your name is Hope. That's something that's revealed pretty early on. So anyways, basically your character is falling down from the top of the screen to the bottom of the screen. And as soon as he hits the bottom of the screen, it wraps back around to the top of the screen. So it's one of those kind of things, right? And if you can move the character left to right, and as you move him left to right, then of course you can wrap back around from the left to the right of the screen. So if you go all the way to the left, then you show up on the right. And the point is to get your character from where he starts to a portal that is located somewhere in the stage. And once you do that, you get into the portal and you move on to the next stage. That's the entire game. So what they kind of add in is that every few levels, they'll add in another element to the game that makes it more complex and interesting. And the way they do that is weird. So, like, it starts off with where you basically get a button that lets you slow down a little bit, which is good because if you hit any obstacle or wall, then you have to start the stage over again. So, you know, you get the chance to slow down. You can also get a function that lets you speed up, because sometimes you'll be falling and there will be walls that are following you, but at a different speed. And you have to, like, continually go left while you're keeping up with the wall that's kind of chasing you. And you can't go too fast because you'll hit the wall that's in front of you. So, you know, they've got, like, things like that. And then they have things where it's like... one of the weird ones to me that's really trippy is that you start off and your character is like quite large and the area that you're in is quite small. Well, if you push the shoulder button, it will zoom the camera out with your character in the center, and you can basically zoom out enough to make obstacles disappear, because if they're not in your direct view, then they aren't actually obstacles, right? So if you can zoom the camera out with your character in the correct position, you can make one of the walls disappear, and then you can freely pass through it. It's really hard to describe, but fortunately, there's actually a really good 6-minute long gameplay video on YouTube, so you can actually see what I'm talking about. Because, yeah, it's just fall puzzles, and it's all about positioning and using the different tools that they kind of give you to get through each of the stages. And there's also collectibles, which have a function that I don't know what they do yet because I haven't beaten the game. It's just like, this is a symbol for A, this is a symbol for G. And, yeah, after you get through the first set of levels... you kind of figure out, you know, like I said, that your character is named Hope, and he washes up on the shores of memory, which is occupied by an elephant. And, you know, he basically is trying to break out of this infinite existence that he is undergoing and try to get back to reality. And he's trying to find the right characters that will bring him back to reality, which is a... Like, one of them is a stoned hippie who talks like a new age guy. One of them's a dog with a bright red tail. I don't know. And, yeah, like I said, each one kind of sends you into another series of levels, of which there seems to be about a little over 100 levels, which is pretty good. And there's also a section for DLC, which is kind of cool.
Nice.
Yeah, it just says prison DLC. I haven't actually downloaded it. But, I really actually quite like this game. Oh, it's $1 for Infinite Prison. I don't know what that is, but I might buy it.
Do it.
Anyways, well, not right now. everybody on the internet's going to hear my credit card number because I have to read it out loud. Just kidding. anyways, I actually really like this game, and it's like kind of feverish presentation. I mean, the backgrounds are trippy. The obstacles are trippy. Like, there's, like, you know, you get... And it they actually kind of make sense. So it's like you're falling through a JPEG of, like, some skies and then a tree canopy and then some trees. And then you're in the then you're in some water and, like, there's walls that are made of fish and, like, things like that. So it's like it kind of makes a little bit of sense. And like I said, I'm interested in the fact that there is a story to it. And the soundtrack is really intriguing. It's a bunch of beats and synthesizer nonsense, which kind of makes my total summary of this game is that it feels like something that, like, Radiohead would have had on their website in the early 2000s, like some flash game that they would have come up with. And I don't know, something in me is quite digs that.
Well, then for $12, what's your verdict on it?
$12, if I would have just seen this game, I wouldn't have bought it. But now that I've played it, I actually think it's worth it. It's a clever puzzle game. Very, very clever. And the presentation is just so audaciously weird that I would say, you know, if you're a fan of weird stuff, then this is definitely an interesting one that you should check out. And like I said, at least watch a gameplay video or something to try and make sense of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, because it's a weird, like, this entire episode has been weird games between friggin' dogs making crepes and SpongeBob SquarePants and...
And it's crepes. Funny because I think this is the only solid buy it of the set this time. And it's, like, arguably the weirdest one.
SpongeBob making crepes, dogs making crepes, Russian spies making crepes.
The world gone topsy-turvy.
Crepe-tastic.
Oh, my Lord. All right, well, that is it for this episode. We made it through another one. Hopefully, it all worked well, and I'll find out when I start editing whether or not the episode is going to be complete or not, because hooray for new computers.
Hooray.
It's a good thing, though.
Hooray. New computer.
I guess if you're going to lose a batch of reviews, though.
Yeah.
You got to be honest. In the event that that happened, this will be the episode to do it on compared to some of the past ones, right?
True. Mm-hmm. So in the event that this episode does make the light of day, does anyone have any final words to end it?
Be careful with crabs you lick. It might be your last.